I learned more than any other thing from my children. My son, he's 7, he's autistic, and I call him my prophet for a reason, because he teaches me to meet myself in ways that are usually very stunning. It's very rare to come across such an embodiment of grace, possibility, and futurity, all wrapped up in a tiny 7-year-old boy's body. And so my son has given me lots of gifts.
Dr. Bayo Akamalafe is a philosopher, psychologist, writer, public intellectual, and founder of the Emergence Network. His work, which he names post-activism, marks an earthwide effort to sensitize bodies towards new responsibilities and other places of power. A project framed within a material feminist, post-humanist, post-activist ethos and inspired by Yoruba indigenous cosmologies. He's the author of These Wilds Beyond Our Fences, Letters to My Daughter on Humanity's Search for Home. Bayo Akamalafe, welcome to One Planet Podcast and the Creative Process.
Thank you very much for having me.
As I look at your journey, you know, it kind of defies these conventional labels in terms of your variety of upbringing between Nigeria, Germany, now India and the United States. And how did all of these countries and cultures shape your worldview and your approach to activism?
Well, I grew up in Nigeria, and growing up in Nigeria meant that I was already quite entangled with Yoruba stories about the transatlantic slave trade, notions of fugitivity, the ideas of the orishas, which spoil easy conventional notions of human agency. So I was brought up in a culture that prepared me for that kind of thinking, that kind of thought. My wife is Indian. So we moved to India when we got married, and my work is increasingly centered in the United States and in the Americas, broadly speaking. So I've had this triangular upbringing between the United States and Asia and Africa that has helped me think about these times and what responding might mean.
So your work often touches on themes of decolonization and indigenous cosmologies,
yes,
particularly Yoruba cosmology. And I understand this is vastly different than, say, the ideas of ownership and domination, say, in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like partnership and relationship, right? So just tell us how that influences your activism and academia as well.
So Yoruba cosmologies have different stories and folkloric content that point to nature and these adventures of the orishas. The orishas are superhuman deities. They have Eshu, Yemaja, Ogun, Shango. Quite critically, during the transatlantic slave trade, they are supposed to have migrated across the Atlantic Ocean to the Americas. There's something about gods in migration that speaks to kind of thinking that I feel that I'm invited into. Yes, you're right about the stabilizing notions of settlement that reduce agency to individuals and reduce property to ownership and all those ideas that are the binary ones that define how we think and how we think about thinking. Maybe something about my upbringing tells me that we don't have agency. The agency is a co-responsive emergent phenomenon within a network of belonging. It emerges within an assemblage. It's not owned by a single body or a single self. So that idea, of course, explored variously in other forms of continental philosophy. If you're familiar with Deleuze and Foucault and, you know, feminist ecologist and feminist materialist, it's not new to say that agency is not reducible to the self. But I seem to have been introduced to that idea quite early. And it informs how I think about activism, agency. It eventually crystallized into my formulation of post-activism, which has as its central tenet the idea that the way we respond to the crisis might very well be the crisis.
Yeah, could you expand a little bit on those themes of post-activism and onto fugitivity? What exactly do those concepts mean to you and how they challenge traditional notions of social change?
So post-activism is not post-activism in the sense of being after activism, right? It's not supposed to be a through line to results or resolutions or solutions. It's not supposed to be a yellow brick road to the futures that we want. It's not supposed to be a spiritual bypass in the ways that people speak about that concept today. It is instead a noticing that the ways that we care for ourselves and our causes and our worlds could actually be incarcerated. Another way to put that is to notice that care can often become carceral. I often suggest that we like to embrace things, but sometimes in the squeeze of embrace, it could quickly become asphyxiation, where we could choke the air out of each other in trying to care for each other. So my noticing that asks, what happens when care becomes troubling? What happens when the very solutions that we're so enamored of becomes part of the paradigm of surveillance? What happens when we are caught up in the very logics that we're trying to outwit, in our very attempts to outwit those logics? For instance, the ways that we are noticing the very righteous and grounded and well-intentioned acts of people in the global north to discard their waste in a conscious and conscientious, very dutiful way, it reinforces a dopaminergic network. It tells them that they're doing good. It suggests a story of goodness and that people should work hard to behave that way. Except if you look at the broader implications, people in the global south receive these discarded waste material. And it's like the goodness is no longer working system. Goodness isn't doing well. So we need other kinds of solidarity. And this is where I start to launch out the conversation about post-activism from.
And so you're the founder of the Emergence Network. And it's very interesting for me to hear someone say that, you know, agency can also be carceral, because often the word agency is used as an empowering word. You know, so for you, it means something else, I guess. And just expand upon that to help me understand. I have a kind of notion of it that when we speak of agency, maybe we're fighting against our nature and imposing ourselves upon nature, you know, it's another kind of man-made imposition, but perhaps I'm reading this wrong.
It really is a post-humanist concept here, that, or lines of thought that we are dancing aside or beside. The idea of post-activism, yes, is heavily indebted to post-humanism. And post-humanism is the refusal to centralize human bodies or human selves or human sociality. It asks, what are human beings depending on in order to create the realities that they believe is reducible to their own act of will? So in many transdisciplinary contexts, we are noticing, for instance, that humans don't choose on their own, and that even their emotional well-being is heavily dependent on the microbes in their guts. So if we're influenced by microbes and environment and ancestrality, then it is almost impossible, at least substantially difficult, to cut off the human from its ecological context, which means that agency is not a matter of a divine, solitary, independent, autonomous self. Instead, it is how environments and ecologies come to create other kinds of openings and possibilities. So it's not that we're saying that there is no agency, it's that we're saying agency is political. And it's ecological and it's ancestral. Maybe one other example to bring it home might be helpful here. There was this study under the banner of epistemic situationism. I think the study examined judges in a court of law and what attributes would be the right and appropriate psychological attributes, characteristics, traits that a judge in a court of law would have. Turns out those attributes that we usually relegate to ourselves are largely dependent on seemingly insignificant things around us. They found, these researchers, that the hardness of the furniture in a court of law shaped the leniency of judges. That is, if you do the crime and you appear before a judge who is seated in comfy, cushiony sofas, then it seems that you're likely to be let off easy. But the harder the furniture, the more harsh the sentence was. Now, this feels upsetting because we would say to ourselves, we made that decision. We thought about it rationally. We went through the process and we came out with our judgments. But it turns out that that's not the way the mind works. This is not new. Ever since anima mundi or archetypal psychology, and even far back into indigenous psychology, we've realized that the mind isn't here. The mind is the psyche, and the psyche is ecological. So agency has never been human. agency is always and has always been post-human.
Yeah, and I really do believe, and physicists tend to, after studying the universe, I mean, so many have said the universe is alive. And, you know, there's a mind in everything, whether it's in the universe or what is the mind of a forest. And we understand that trees can communicate with each other, which we never thought, through the soil, their mycelial network. So I really think, I shouldn't even use those words, I think, because I wonder, is it my gut and I'm sitting on the comfy sofa and all these things that accumulate to produce the words that come out of my mouth, which could just be a series of sounds and symbols. That would be the long way of saying it. But I think it does, it's important to question. We say, oh, in the Western tradition, I think, therefore I am. I am the collection of my thoughts. But what about all this body and, you know, the environment I live in, and how did they influence it? It's really important to understand how you come to that thought that you think you had, like you gave birth to it. Maybe it's the planet giving birth to you who had the thought. So I think it's really important just to readjust our thinking. Like, we live on this planet, and I guess we think, oh, it's beneath our feet, so we're above it. But actually, it's supporting us. You know, that's another way of thinking about it as we go around on it. You wrote in your book, you know, these wilds beyond our fences, you explore fatherhood and its cosmic implications. How did becoming a father transform your understanding of self and the world? I mean, it's quite moving.
Well, things kind of became very real when I held my daughter. Okay, I have to provide. I have to get my act together. I have to address this. I have to think of that. And then I came to a point where it seemed like the world wasn't enough. Like, my daughter had come out of the world, and yet the world she'd come out of felt strangely hostile to her flourishing. How would she flourish in a world that seems to be devoted to straight lines instead of life-affirming lines, that seems to be devoted to a centrality of appearance, to white modernity, and does not really appreciate her beige skin? Like, what would it look like for my daughter to flourish? And what kind of world can host her body? And so, you know, realizing that I was suddenly in a Tupac situation, me against the world, I decided to write and to think along the lines of my writing, to address my daughter, to address the world she was coming into, and to leave letters that she might trace so that she can think for herself and come to experiment with a world that is always full of surprises.
Yeah. And then how did just that whole experience of fatherhood became intertwined with your philosophy? I mean, were there things that were like theoretical that you understood, but then you understood in a real physical level and this kind of relationship to time and future generations that I can imagine arises when you bring life into the world?
Yes, things became real. Up to that time, I was researching and reading and thinking along with civilizational demise, thinking about climate chaos and all of that. But not until I held my daughter did things start to become really urgent. And so a dual slit experiment became not just a fanciful physics experiment or phenomenon. It became for me a way to disrupt time in its linearity. It became a way for me to think about bodies as much more than what appears. It became a way for me to think about virtual particles and how identity is not as stable. So my daughter was the crystallizing force that allowed these ideas and theories and concepts to become real against their previous virtuality.
Yes, and you've been involved with organizations like Science and Non-Duality. And how do you adapt your conversations when you're dealing with these groups or speaking to scientists? I mean, we all have different ways of communicating and a different set of basic truths, but it can be difficult to open people's minds sometimes. You know, I know you give workshops and you have an upcoming retreat. And so how do you adapt to those different languages and those different ways of communicating and understanding the world? These really, you know, complex ideas, but at their essence, they're something that we can all relate to once they're expressed in a way that speaks to all.
Well, I am a member of too many organizations, work with just as many or even more. And if there were a running theme that I feel constantly beckons on the kind of thinking that I'm peddling and trafficking into modernity, it would be the idea that we're not alone and that we don't have to figure things out on our own. perhaps much more than the others, it would be the idea of entanglement, which has been popularized in mainstream culture as some kind of suspicious compost heap or life. It's just like a goop where everything is everything else, which is not the idea of entanglement at all that I'd like to think about. The idea of entanglement that I think about is the notion of post-humanism, which I've just shared with you. It's the idea that even though it seems we're disconnected from the world around us, physical contiguity is no barrier to entanglement, that we are derived from systems, that we, when we try to change the world, we are within the world we're trying to change. You know, there's something humbling about Chinua Achebe's retort to the Archimedean idealist that proclaims, give me a place to stand and I shall move the world. And Chinua Achebe responds, but there is no place to stand. We are of the world and we must move at its pace. I think that idea of moving at the world's pace is a disabling thought. And I mean disabling in the most complimentary sense. I mean it as a coming to terms with other modes of moving, other modalities of negotiating our realities. And it's courageous. It's a grounding, a coming down to earth. So yeah, that's what connects these multiple organizations by some degree.
And so as you think of the next 20 years, I don't know what your reflections are, you know, the future for Africa and India's place in the world. And as we see their rise, how does that, these areas of the world that have been for so long dominated, how will they become more a part of the conversation? I mean, what are your hopes? We can also see it going in a way that's not ideal, but what are your hopes for that?
My hopes for these spaces becoming part of a conversation.
What do you think about, you know, Africa and India in the next 20 years? And also, hopefully, these regions who have been so long dominated, and how can it be more equitable?
Well, I hope it doesn't become equitable. If equity here is intended as a common threshold of measurement, I would say, you know, I think we live through agonistic worlds. That is, it's uneven. It's not supposed to be balanced, right? Modernity is the presumption of balance or smoothness. At the same time, I don't know how to speak in terms of 20 years out, 50 years out, 100 years out. The stories that promulgated white modernity are becoming exhausted and too tired to sustain the weight of the crises of this time. Some people call it a meta-crisis. Some people just call it a catastrophe. Whatever we want to call it, it seems we are in a lot of trouble as a species. And we need new stories. We need new ways of speaking about time, agency, accountability, responsibility, the self, all of that. Just so happens to be the case that these places you've mentioned have beautiful accounts of the world. They're not meant to be taken as final truths. They are speculative becomings and fabulations that have been crystallized over generations to offer some kind of a path through the forests of crises that we're undergoing or navigating right now. India is already involved. Africa is already involved. The Yoruba culture creolized the world, creolized the Americas. And I think I'm looking for a kind of creolizing politics that continues to do that.
Yes, alternative versions of the world. It's clear that the model of capitalism isn't working for everyone or most of us. And that story needs to be retold anew, I think. New ways of, in my opinion, cooperation, or be it socialism. But right now, as you know, the world's top 1% owns more wealth than 95% of humanity. That's just out of the new Oxfam analysis. And it's just, it's really heartbreaking. And I don't know if you would necessarily like to speculate on capitalism and economics, but what do you feel is wrong about it? And how can it be more inclusive, as you say, these other worldviews that are more compassionate and have more empathy?
Well, capitalism is, alongside with whiteness as a political project and neurotypicality as a governance of bodies, you know, it creates this three-headed hydra dragon space whose intent is to describe, explain, predict, control, surveil, archive. Sometimes I think capitalism is not just simply about profit. It's about capture. It's about the legibility of how we show up in the world. A lot of our politics is geared towards emphasizing inclusion within these systems. I think these systems are becoming tired. And not that I would subscribe to a take down capitalism moment. I think my work is about inviting people to cultivate new kinds of perceptions and senses that might open up new ways of being in the world. It really is an invitation to stay with the minor gestures emerging now. So to answer your question, I think a lot of what passes as politics is devoted to an anti-capitalist project, which in my view, reinforces and re-centralizes capitalism. So we need a different approach. We need a different kind of politics that knows how to do that kind of work of sidestepping capitalism.
I think that that's so true. It takes a bit of courage because a lot of us have been indoctrinated from the time we were born and we can't see beyond. But there is always something beyond. We just have to have that political, economic courage, I think. So I have a question here from one of our participating students, and she writes, in your writing, everything sins, everything misses the mark. You talk about how you cannot reject selfishness, even though it conflicts with the community necessary to heal and create change. Could you elaborate on how to reconcile the individual ego with your community projects and visions?
There is no reconciliation. There is only an exquisite misalignment. There is no keyhole analysis here. There is no coming to terms. I'm a monadologist, if you will. I think about a flat world thesis. That is, it is the fluctuations of a field of differentiating differences that creates a mic, a purse, a phone, and laptops and me, right? It's this undulating field that constantly creates. In that sense, you could say that the ego is already ecological. The ego is not a category apart from the ecological. The ego is a manifestation of the ecological. Our brains are manifestations of microbes and viruses and stuff. This is the reason why, for instance, I refuse to pathologize selfishness, right? Because I feel selfishness is how love meets itself. We're so well practiced in thinking that the world is to be divided between one side and the other, and that the purpose of politics is for one side to triumph over the other side. It obscures too much.
Yes, and you've spoken about family, about being a father, a husband, the importance of ancestry in your work, you know, our conversations with the previous generations. And I know that your father had passed away. I believe that that was an important moment. How did that reshape your thinking about the world? How do you continue to have conversations? What is your connection to him? And how did that help form you in a way?
My father was my best friend. When he passed away, it was like, there's no way to describe it. There's absolutely no way to describe those first moments when I realized that my father had passed away and was no more. Yeah. I spoke about holding my daughter and realizing, wow, things are getting real. I have to be a father to this beautiful daughter now. My father's passing was my first get real moment. I think up until that time, it was ice cream and television. With my father's passing, I quickly had to become the breadwinner, so to speak. I had to cook on the streets of Lagos, you know, do barbecue chicken to send my sisters to school to help us eat. My father exposed me to a world beyond the bubblegum realities that I'd previously occupied. And I'm still there. He still attends to my work. He still leans in now and then to see how I'm doing.
That's so important. And they are close, even though we don't see them.
I believe so.
I have another question from Natalie. Having grown up in a Christian family with a diplomat father, how do you think these experiences have shaped your ideas of justice and collaboration?
Closely tied to my father's passing, I believe justice was a final kind of answer, something that was going to vanquish the enemy that was called death. It's in the Bible, right? That death is the final enemy to be vanquished. I think it's somewhere in the book of Revelations lurking there in those pages. I saw justice as a just output, the thing that one deserves, the consequence for one's actions, until I started to notice that justice wasn't some cosmic principle. It was a deeply political process accommodated within modern algorithms that reinforces, recreates, and sometimes affirms the kind of logics we're trying to escape. So I've written many times that I think that often gets in the way of transformation. I didn't have this kind of thinking while I was growing up a Christian. It'd been abominable to think in this way. Once you've had your world shaken and you start to think in terms of process instead of outcomes, then it's easier to see that justice is just one of several ways that the world can articulate what it means to be morally culpable or to be embedded within a world of systems and nuance and complexity.
I think it's true. And the legal system, you know, there are other ways that aren't necessarily codified, but tradition is that, and of course, religion. So Natalie asks again, certain religions have historical ties with colonialism, but I wonder how they might fit into a decolonial present and future.
Well, religion isn't stable either, right? It's constantly upending its own self. Belief is constantly upending its own self. I think, I can't remember where I read this, but there are two new religions every day. I think there is not a single headline category called religion, that we are constantly shaping and creating new gods and new notions of the sacred. And by we, I don't mean humans. I mean the assemblage that holds humans. It's constantly searching for and upending and creating other kinds of gods. And so, of course, one has to affirm that Christianity came to Africa, for instance, with a Bible and with a pencil and with a gun. And it insisted that its only way of worship was the only way possible. I don't think we're there right now. I think Christianity, too, is morphing. You know, there's something about decolonization that takes from the master and twists the master's tools into something unrecognizable, which is how I think about ontofugitivity, a question I didn't quite answer when you posed it to me the first time. So yeah, I think decolonizing Christianity is not setting it up on a new platform. It's not assuring diversity in religious spaces of power. It is the idea of noticing that religion isn't still and that we're constantly invited into new performances of the sacred.
Yeah, it's difficult. And I wonder, you seem someone who, I don't know if hopeful or optimistic is the way to frame it, but who doesn't want to focus on problems and solutions, but it's a more holistic. But where do you find that hope or that energy? Because it can be so difficult, whether you want to call it a climate crisis or a biodiversity crisis, it can be difficult to renew that source of optimism and energy and strength.
Speaking of hope, of course, you know of Pandora's box. I worry about the insidious effects of hope and how hope can actually perpetuate cyclicity, keep us in familiar methods or patterns of behaving that only reinforce the conditions that hope is trying to get us out from. So I wouldn't say that my work is about seeking a wholeness. My work is, in some sense, actually about doing the opposite. It's about sniffing out the cracks within wholeness so that our bodies can transmutate into other kinds of things. So that's the reason why I wouldn't say it's about solutions or problems. It's about shape-shifting. It's about using the ingredients of these moments to form a new kind of altar, to look differently, think differently, talk differently, not as a religious imperative, but as a way of relating, experimenting tentatively with a world that is alive.
I'm Natalie McCarthy, and I study English and journalism at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. As I'm listening to Bayo Akamalafe, it's clear to me that he is someone who seeks answers beyond the binaries that we've been presented with and that we continue to confine ourselves within as we seek change. As someone on a college campus, which can be an epicenter of political action, I'm really struck by the idea that our response to crisis may be part of the crisis and that our care can become carceral. Last spring, I got to take a class where we studied the interactions between religions and economic and political systems, and this led me to a larger research project about religious anti-carceral movements, particularly the Christian ones in the United States South. The idea behind these movements is that our current codified law system, set by a federal government, is arbitrary and unnatural and often unnecessarily cruel. So these people are turning to other ethical codes, like those laid out in their religions. Essentially, they look to trade one notion of justice for another. And though these anti-carceral movements are often still more empathetic than our current justice system, I think Bio Akamalafe brings up a really valuable point when he discusses capitalism and anti-capitalist movements. He introduces this idea that resistance movements can often recenter the oppressive one. Additionally, his commentary on the transience and instability of organized religion as a foundation for progress has added a new layer to this sustained interest of mine. I'm left asking myself whether or not our carceral system would really be more ethical if it's passed over to yet another man-made moral code. I think we often seek answers by discerning between the lesser of two pre-existing evils, but the foundation of Bio Akamalafe's work seems to be an exploration of something entirely new. He talks about how definitions of justice are still part of modern algorithms, which has led me to reconsider what justice means to begin with, and how I can recenter my research to accommodate something that has largely been defined for me and may need to be deconstructed and reconstructed. I feel that my research thus far is focused on binaries, you know, the idea that one system should prevail over another. And this interview has really broadened this outlook and pushed me to look for waves of change that exist somewhere beyond, between, or beneath the systems laid out for me. And now back to the interview.
It seems that listening to you and reading your writings, it seems to be like an act of listening too, like learning from the earth. I know that, of course, you're a teacher, you have a forthcoming retreat, you have all these ways of teaching in the world to try to pass on the knowledge that you have. Who have been those important teachers for you beyond your father? Like, how do you learn from the earth, and how do you learn from these other teachers or mentors in your life, even your children?
Yeah, you're right about my children. I learn more than any other thing from my children. My son, he's 7, he's autistic, and I call him my prophet for a reason, because he teaches me to meet myself in ways that are usually very stunning. I can get information from other people. I can read a book here and there, but it's very rare to come across such an embodiment of grace, possibility, and futurity, all wrapped up in a tiny 7-year-old boy's body. And so my son has given me lots of gifts.
That's wonderful how wisdom can come to us in many ways, but we have to open ourselves. And so in your own teachings, I know you're not like a prescription, follow this method. How do you approach that? And it, of course, it's also teaching outside the classroom with retreats or these other kinds of more one-on-one. I mean, just tell me your approach.
My approach to teaching, I just go out there and speak. Teaching is my life's work. I enjoy the beauty of creating concepts, of writing these concepts, of thinking along with them. I'm constantly in the search for new monstrous concepts that I might loose wild upon the city, and they would come back to me with tales of their adventures. It's the most fascinating thing to me. So yes, I teach, sister. I don't know how. I'm not sure where this gift comes from, this alien gift. But yes, I love to teach.
Yeah. And I think that I, as someone speaking a lot to young people, there is anxiety. I don't like to overemphasize it. But what are those questions that they ask you, or how do you allay that? Because there is a great hunger. And of course, because they're going to have more future ahead of them than us, it weighs heavier on them. How do you reach them?
Yes, I'm constantly in touch and speaking our younger siblings. And there is a sense in which our politics is creating more veterans, because it seems our politics is stuck tired. So I often invite young people to follow this exhaustion and not to try to get around it, pathologize it, or just dismiss it out of hand. That the exhaustion of this moment is a gift, and it's a place of, you might even say, entrepreneurial opportunity to recreate new kinds of possibilities with the world. It feels like my central message. It's more than just do what you want. It's more than just succeed. I've given 2 commencement speeches, and I usually ended by asking people to fail generously, which they might explain as failing forward. It's a new catchphrase. And I've reminded people, I'm not speaking about failing forward. This is different. So I tell young people to fail, to explore that failure, instead of throwing paint at the shop that you think is contributed to climate chaos in the UK, then maybe we explore other kinds of socialities and fugitive arrangements. And that is, in a sense, my thesis for young people.
Yeah, I think it's really important, and nothing beats failure but a try. And I think we just have to get used to it, because that is, of course, life. Going back to those concepts that you referred to, and of course, you've just come back from a trip to San Francisco. Some of those terms are used by technologists: post-humanism, emergence. Have you heard your network is called Emergence? But I think when I hear it from the people from Silicon Valley, it means something very different. You know, it's the world of AI and virtual reality and these things. So I guess, like, contrast it to those concepts. And is there a place for those two different, because they're very different worldviews, to meet? You know, there are the techno-optimists, the tech-utopian. I'm actually speaking to Gerard Lanier in about an hour, who invented virtual reality. So that's a different world, and it's utopian. And I think that you and I are on the same page. Like, I prefer real reality in nature. But is there a place for us to meet? Can we use our combined intelligence and energy to create an emergence that speaks to both sides of the camp?
I think what many people think of as post-humanism from the lips of tech bros in Silicon Valley is actually transhumanism, not post-humanism. Transhumanism is humanism on steroids. It's the future of control. And one day we might be able to live forever. We might be able to do everything we want. We don't need to get up to get a haircut. We won't need to get up to breathe. We would just assign it to a bot, an AI tool or a robot to do for us. Yes, I get that. Most of the conversations thus surrounds AI as a tool in the ways I've just described. And in other settings, AI is a tool or a threat. In my opinion, AI is also a trickster. You know, of course, there's nothing that emerges in these times that is not already part of harmful exercises. AI has data centers that are built on the backs of Africans, for instance. There's nothing to be romanticized about this. And in the age of Trump and Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg, it's a very tempting thing to treat them as villains, but also to leave out the outsized role these harmful technologies can play on our children and our ecologies. But I think AI is also a troubling crack in human exclusivity. I don't think it's about merging our intelligences together. I think intelligence is not human. We don't have intelligence. So AI, in the words of my dear sister Vanessa Andriotti, is already a misnomer. Artificial intelligence suggests it's a step down from where we are. We natural intelligences, I don't think either of us has intelligence. It's not a property to own. Instead, intelligence is a field that enlists bodies in how it comes to matter. And it turns the whole world upside down because it means we're not in charge and we're not the ones running the operation. The world might enlist plastic. It might enlist other kinds of bodies, microbes, whiteboards, to be intelligent in the ways that we've accommodated the concept. But the world is much more than that.
I think that that's true. Intelligence, if I could think about it in that more expansive view, is that, you know, when in doubt, I look to nature. Often the problems that we have and we're trying to reform nature or reform the world into our image is like it was solved in nature. If you go back, it was solved. So I think that that is the intelligence, the beautiful symmetry and mathematics of nature or harmony. So maybe can you also share, because you lived and you've traveled even further for your work and your teachings, your reflections and memories on the beauty and wonder of the natural world? You must have had some amazing encounters with the world.
I love mountains to bits. You might see them in everything I do, but I love mountains, especially when mountains are devastatingly huge, like elders, and they're looking down on this tiny, fleeting particle that I am. I like to be overwhelmed with awe, and mountains do that very well. They overwhelm me in a good way. They allow me to see that I'm not as important as my head thinks I am.
Yes, the archaeologist Jack Horner told me that, I mean, I don't have his deep sense of geological time, but when he looks at rock formations or mountains, he can see back in time, geological time, to the ocean that it once was. I guess it's a deposit of all these things. I said, wow, I'd love to have that sense. Then you feel your infinitesimal smallness.
Yes.
Just to include,
yes.
Yeah, it's amazing. Really, everything I think is alive in a way. We just don't know it. We have to tune in. So as you think about the future, of course, the kind of world we're leaving for the next generation, that, you know, that ancestral wisdom and the things that you've picked up along the way that have given your life meaning,
yes.
What would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Well, I would just invite young people to stay with the trouble. As I say, the times are urgent, let us slow down, which is not an invitation to jettison activism. It's more an invitation to stretch the meaning of activism, to notice activism's minor gestures, to notice that we are in a time when the elder, the archetypes, the trickster, you know, the leader, all these archetypes seem to be broken and we need something more now. And I think young people hold so much of the key, needing to blast open new kinds of possibilities.
And there's not just one key. I think there's many keys, and you've provided many today with grace and clarity. So thank you, Bayo Akamalafe, for sharing your purpose and vision, helping us make sense of our disconnection with the earth by reframing the ways we think about the climate crisis and introducing us to new ways of speculation and conceptions. You open up new ways of being in the world. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
The Creative Process and One Planet Podcast is supported by the Ian Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Natalie McCarthy with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sam Myers and Natalie McCarthy. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcast, or be part of the climate change solution, just follow us on Instagram at Creative Process Podcast and send us a DM. Thank you for listening.